podcast was recorded on an epic journey. I did the New Zealand Comedy Festival for 2 weeks in Auckland, and then I did a Best of the Fest tour going all over the country. And one of the guys I worked with was Chris Martin, not the dude from that terrible band, A Man Unto Himself. I saw Chris Martin at the Classic in Auckland, and I thought, you know, cute guy. I only watched a minute of his set. But then working with him for these 2 weeks, I fell in love with this guy. He carries his notebook around. He's got the same moleskin notebook that I do. He uses it differently, but I was really impressed by this younger comedian constantly scribbling in his book and consulting it before he went on stage, and he totally gained my respect. He's a wonderful performer. His father is a collector of antique books, so you know the man has class. And I was really happy to make this friendship with this guy. I think he's going to be an absolute comedy beast in the future. And he's a darling comedian right now as it is. It's my pleasure to present to you now the one and only Mr. Chris Martin. Chris Martin, ladies and gentlemen. Chris Martin. Now, we're at the tail end of our New Zealand countrywide tour for the Convoy Comedy Tour. And I've gotten to know you a little bit. And I think you're one of the most competitive British guys I've ever met in my life.
That's funny you say that, yeah.
I think it's refreshing.
Really? Do you think we normally give up too easily?
Yeah, and you guys aren't known for athleticism and you say whinger, we say complainer.
Okay, yeah, we do that a lot.
You're very American for a British guy.
Really?
Maybe so. You're spunky and you got a good spirit.
I watched a lot of Saved by the Bell when I was younger.
That's what it was?
Mate, A.C. Slater's really shaped my life for me. I didn't realise. Yeah, no, I don't know. I used to hide being competitive. And now I just let go. Just wear it on my sleeve, mate.
I like it, man. Like you have played every game we have played to the death. You have been serious about miniature golf, about go-karting, about the little cricket and rugby, everything.
The game we played in Christchurch backstage that Guy invented, throwing rugby balls at chairs. It was political chairs.
That got sweaty, mate.
And then Jesse Griffin just gamesmanship me. It was frustrating, actually. I'm still annoyed about it.
Where does that come from? Oh, my favorite part of the trip so far was when we were doing the miniature golf and you were trash-talking everybody. And you're like, yeah, well, you're all going to, you know, bow down to my greatness here shortly. And you're talking so much shit to everybody. And there was this big overhanging plant that touched your face. And you thought it was a bug or something. And you were,
It was higher than that. Like that's my mate, I can't help it. I was out of nowhere. It was a shock. Come on. Mate, if you didn't know what was coming, it could be anything.
And you're in a foreign country. You don't know what lurks.
It could be a poisonous spider or something. Apparently they're in Australia. Not here. But yeah. No, I do. I love a bit of trash talk's always funny in those sort of events.
You guys are great. And, you know, you're younger than me. And you got Guy Williams and Jesse Griffin. And you guys have been very boyish in running and jumping and playing. And
you've got to have... Well, because, like, do you not find on the road on your own often is really boring? So it's like, it's nice to have a crew of people you can do more. I'd never be chucking rugby balls at chairs with the amount of circuit gigs I do. The people never want to do that. So... I don't know, just embrace it. I feel like I'm on holiday over here as well.
It's been fun. It's been a fun tour.
Yeah, we've worked every night but one night, pretty much.
Yeah.
But it still doesn't feel like work. That's why it's great. Then you know you're having a good time.
What do you... And I'm also impressed that you're constantly writing material and working on material.
Yeah, it's like... That's probably the competitive thing as well. I think it comes from... I don't know. It's like I just need... I'm a bit of a perfectionist with it. And it's just... I get annoyed when stuff doesn't... You know, I don't know. I just like... I hate... Some people are very good at... You know, some people you gig with, they come off stage and they go, that was cool, and it's like, fine. But I don't know, I get too annoyed. I've had those gigs enough of my life. I try and... Sometimes I need to just chill out and just let it come, you know what I mean? Sometimes it's like I put too much thought into it and I need to... I don't know how you think fine when you're doing material, but sometimes if you just relax and do it...
It's if you overthink it, it usually kills the mojo.
That's right.
But it's been really inspiring for me as an older guy. I mean, you know, you're working on material constantly, and then you're not eating meat. You're constantly exercising and maintaining your little athletic 28-inch waist.
But that's... I don't know why that is. My dad is really... You know, it's like looking at a crystal ball, a really overweight crystal ball. My dad is, like, the most hilarious man I know. But he is, like... He's my height and weighs 20. We've talked about this before. 22 stone or 7 pounds?
I have no idea.
300 pounds or some shit? 280 pounds?
Wow.
He was that. Then he lost about 25 pounds doing those boot camps. But there's nothing wrong with doing it. People, you know, do what you want to do. But I just find that, I don't know, it's like all joined together. When I've eaten shit and I'm feeling shit, then I don't feel creative. It's like if I'm really hungover, I can't write. So I don't know. I just hate having wasted days. Because you make your own hours in this job, I think. And you can do loads of different ways of treating it. Sometimes you've got to take a day off, but I just find that I've ever like got wasted or something and I feel bollocks the next day. I go, oh, that's fine. But then I'm just, it's like another opportunity that I could have been working. I sound like a psycho, don't I?
You do. So you have a fear of having your father's body.
Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with it really, but it's useful for him. He can, the belly is at a level where he can just rest glasses of drink and food on top. So, you know, it's got its benefits.
Your dad sounds like a cool guy. So what he deals, he's a collector and dealer of first edition books and antique books, things like that?
Yeah, he deals old books. He sells old documents and stuff online and at book fairs. I said when you come to London, you've got to come to one of his things. You'll find
I want to meet your dad. He sounds like an older version of me.
He loves meeting comedians. He really like turns it on when he'll swear more when he's a comedian around. Cool. And he's like in a posh voice. It's really funny. He's like, oh yeah, it's completely, the world's gone to shit. Just starts dropping that in for no reason. Oh, the world's, country's fucked. Like that. He loves it. He'd love to meet you.
What have been your father's greatest scores for documents or books?
My father's greatest scores. He just like, he's had a couple of times where someone, because the people he works with are really old. I think his best thing was just an old guy died and he had no friends or family. So he gave my dad his whole like archive, which is just massive. And just through that, he's made like funded him for like 5 years.
Put the kids through college, everything.
Yes. Yeah, he did. And he's really happy that I'm using my education well to be talking shit on stage.
We all know the comedy's the best job there is, buddy. What do you mean? Sit in a cubicle and worry about money, funds, things like that?
Do you find it weird? This is something that I've seen a few comedians do when they go, yeah, so I'm a comedian now, so as you can imagine, my parents are thrilled. But
yeah, no,
my parents are always like, if you get paid for it and it's fun, if I can do it.
My parents are just glad I'm not in prison.
Really? Is that like a thing that would have happened in your neighborhood?
No, they just, you know, they didn't know how I was going to turn out.
Just put the bar low and then you're
the fact that, yeah. The fact that I'm, you know, traveling, making money.
Yeah, that's good.
So how influential was your father? Must be an intelligent guy if that's what he's made his living at.
Yeah, he's quite intelligent.
So did you grow up in a house full of old books and Napoleon signatures?
Yeah, but do you know what it is? Like, this is like, as you get older, you start, and it sounds not in a arsey way, because obviously I know, relatively speaking, to a lot of people, I'm not old, but when you're like being told, he was like, he made me come to all these book fairs and stuff, and you know, you're just forced.
So you hated it, right?
Yeah, so you're forced to do shit. So you don't, off your own back, go, oh, that's something I really. I've got this theory that I've been like chucking out there, no one agrees with me on, but I think, depending on what you're like, but only like since, I'd say, mid-20, 25 onwards, have I like had a thirst for wanting to know stuff. Because just in conversation as an adult, like you've been telling loads of interesting anecdotes and talking about loads of music, and I just don't know any of it. And then that's what makes me want to learn about that shit. But when you're like forced into knowing stuff when you're a kid, I basically think everyone should be made to go to school till they get all the basics at an age, and then just like let out into the world to just work and just learn about the world for a few years. Then you can come back into education when you're like 23, 24, 25, and you want to. Because even like university, for me, was like everyone I know went to it. And I went to it because I was like, I wanted to get out of London. I thought it'd be interesting. But I didn't, and I did English. But I still don't, I did it, but I didn't do it to like, I wasn't going, I really want to learn extra. So I was going, what's the shortest way I can get a respectable grade? Which sounds a bit shit, really. But that was just, I think, at the time where my head was.
So you studied what, English literature?
English literature. And I got 2.1, which is like the stat, everyone goes, you should get 2.1. It's like a good grade. The first is the amazing one. I don't know how it works in America. First is like you've really worked hard and done extra work. But 2.1, everyone should get, really. And they call a 2.2 a Desmond.
A Desmond?
Desmond Tutu. Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
See, there's that London Cockney
stuff. There you go. Yeah, Cockney rhyming.
You love your Cockney rhyming.
Yeah, though I do make it up sometimes, and I don't know how accurate.
But you're from the poshest place in London I've ever been in my life. So yeah. I think it's you're from Chiswick.
Yes.
Or as an American would say, Chiswick.
Chiswick. Yeah. No, I am from like a posh background, but I am, unlike everyone I went to school with, so we went to a really posh school, is I used to play football or soccer with all the kids from the estate. And so, like, when I was at 8, I went down there speaking like this. Hello, how's it going? Just got bullied to shit. So I had to sort of...
Not rich white kid.
Exactly. So you had to, I had to, like survival of the fittest, mate. I had to evolve to survive.
But you tried to harden up a little bit, and you tried to hide your honky poshness. I like that.
Yeah, I don't know. Some people are, you know what I mean?
You could have been a twat. You could have easily turned out a tit.
Yeah. I love that. That's your parents' attitude to your thing. You're not in prison. You're like, I could have, Chris, you could have been an arsehole, and you're not. So congratulations on being slightly above that. Yeah, no, I don't know. But I just learned to survive speaking this way, I guess.
But yeah, so you told me you moved out of Chiswick, what, a couple of years ago, and you moved to a harder part of London?
Yeah, it's a bit more...
Hampstead Heath?
No, Buckingham Palace, you know? It's where you get there, mate. I've got to ride chariots and shit, no engines. No, I moved to northwest London, which is like... It's one of those, it's becoming a bit trendy, but like, it's just a bit more normal. It's like, you get to see people from different cultures and backgrounds, which are quite... It sounds so wanky. I like to be near people from ethnic backgrounds so I can get a feel for them. But no, it's interesting because where I was from is like, everyone is middle class and white and like the same. And
I can dig. I mean, I had to move from Florida to New York City and then to San Francisco to be around ethnic international people. And I craved that. I mean, I was around white suburban people. I wanted flavor, you know?
So yeah.
I don't condemn your west, north.
Is that a weird thing for us? Is that the sound? Will people think that's like RC to be like, is that sound patronizing?
I looked at it as more like just wanting to experience the world and people.
Yeah.
And to become smarter and worldly, you know, instead of staying in the little radius of where I grew up in.
Yeah, like, I mean, I've got really good friends still who I went to school with, but they've been around the world and stuff, and they've, you know, I moved in with some from school to where I live in, but they have this, they're very scared of, well, not scared, they're reticent to make friends with anyone who's outside of this, like, public school, their age vibe, because of, like, comedy. Like, the great thing is, like, you know, people of different ages, different nationalities, different...
I love it. The thing I love the most about comedy, I've said many times, is... Doesn't matter if, you know, you're black or Asian or a woman or a man or gay or handicapped or whatever. The only criterion is that you're funny.
And not an asshole.
Well, there's a lot of assholes in the business, but they're usually not the funny ones.
Yeah, I mean, I meant like in terms of who you want to embrace and hang out with. You got to be funny. I don't know. You don't have to think someone's amazingly funny to hang out with them, I guess. But yeah. There are people that make it to the top by being assholes, but I don't like those stories. I like to believe everyone's a nice guy.
Right. But now, I spent January in London, and three weeks of that month, I stayed in Chiswick.
Yeah.
And I had just discovered the neighborhood. That was one of the nicest areas of London I've ever been to. You got fantastic restaurants, the greatest supermarkets. And I do the joke about the... I've done it forever about the English food is bad and the Germans should have dropped cookbooks on you fucking people.
Yeah.
But Chiswick destroys that notion of there being bad food in England.
Yeah.
That little village alone.
Well, you just go to like, oh yeah, there's a few, mate, you're lucky, you went, like 5 years ago, there wasn't a Waitrose, but then they upped their game, mate.
The
Waitrose
God.
Is the one that all the middle class mums like opened up their vaginas and had another kid because they can be born into this world.
Yeah.
You can get all sorts of lovely stuff there.
Jesus, great soups, Indian food.
Yeah. They make even your micro meals are right. Really good. They've got that in Marks and Spencer's, the other one, you know. There's no Lidl. That's just so like, do you have that equivalent in America? Lidl is like the proper budget, like they pre-break your biscuits in packets and shit.
Hmm.
And it's proper, like everything's like 8p. That's like the...
So what was it like growing up there? You had a little sailor suit and a big lollipop and a yeah. hat with a bonnet with a ribbon on it?
Yeah, that was it, man. I was breastfed till I was 9. It was good. No, it was fine. It was, I had to play football with more of a diverse crowd. So I had to sort of not be like, hello, how's everyone doing? I had to speak a bit more worldly wisely.
And then there's also that fabulous gig there in Chiswick. What's the George Pub or
the George IV? And there's a headliners at the back. I remember when I used to be obsessed with stand up comedy. I used to love Jack D and Eddie as well when I was like a teenager going to school. And I always said to my dad, I want to go to comedy school because that's what I used to see on TV. The Paramount Comedy used to have Live from the Store. And
right.
You'd see people like Reg Hunter, maybe even Tom Stade back then. I'd see, but these guys were amazing. And then that opened at the back of there. Probably like when I was 16, maybe 10 or 11 years ago. And it said like lineups at the Comedy Store. So I used to go down all the time before I was 18. when I really wanted to try and do comedy, and I sort of chatted to Blake. They used to have on, Jeannie Asheray was on all the time.
Oh, you love
Jeannie. She's doing great in LA, and Michael McIntyre. And I remember speaking to the guy. So Michael McIntyre, if anyone is like, at the moment, the most popular British comedian by quite a long way, I think, up there with Peter Kay, but as in terms of newer. But the guy kept saying, this guy's the best act on the circuit. I think he'd come up really quick. Mm-hmm. I remember people saying, this guy's come. And I remember watching him, and like, more than anything, his crowd work was just like, him and Jimmy Carr actually was also, just before Jimmy Carr.
Love Jimmy Carr.
Jimmy Carr came on with a little clipboard. He used to come on with a clipboard.
Yeah.
And he just started doing, but you know when you like, it's amazing how when someone's on TV as a comedian, that's always, even if you don't know comedy especially, you think that's the barometer for how good they are. So I remember Jimmy Carr was on a show called Your Face or Mine on E4, which is like quite a kind of stupid teenage thing with a woman called June Sarpong, where you'd have a couple on. Do you ever see this show?
Mm-mm.
A guy and a girl, and they'd go on and they'd start off by rating two different, like, they'd photos of couples saying who's more attractive, and at the end, for the big money, they'd have to decide between them who's more attractive out of the girlfriend and the boyfriend. Which is kind of a stupid show, but it was quite amusing.
That sounds like, that show should be called Relationship Ender.
How to never get laid again if your missus. Yeah, but that was, I recognised him from that, and he came out, and you just get that weird excitement, and especially then, like, oh, you're like, oh my God, this guy's off this fucking show. But he smashed it. I remember he tore into me, because I did that thing of sitting in the front. I was like, oh yeah, front row. And I sort of asked him a question. He was like, how old are you? Like 9. And then just shredded me. But I loved every minute.
Have you ever met him since then?
No, I haven't actually.
So you never got to tell him that story?
No, I haven't told him that.
You shit on me when I was 16.
Yeah, mate, you're the reason I do this, motherfucker. Yeah, you're the reason I've got an armory of things to say to young people in gigs. No, I haven't given him since.
I worked with Jimmy Carr when I, years ago when I was coming to, first going to England, and we did a gig together in Wales in Cardiff.
Yeah.
And it was a very tough one-nighter, and I drove there with him, and he's Mr. Posh guy in his BMW, and I really liked him. We hit it off instantly, but we got there, and it was like kind of a, you know, I don't want to say farmer audience, but just not, you know, city hipsters.
I'm with you.
And I thought to myself, these people are going to eat his lunch.
Yeah.
And he goes up there and he was doing his posh thing with the one-liners and they ate his lunch.
Really?
It was but I respect the guy. And we drove home and the car broke down and we ended up walking along the highway together for like miles and really became good friends. I'm still buddies with him.
Really? That's amazing.
But I love Jimmy. And the fact that he did not capitulate with those people. He didn't like start, you know, getting all cockney and shit. He stuck to his program.
He did his thing.
Yeah.
Which is, I got told by Jared Christmas, actually, talking about Jimmy Carr, how Jimmy used to, I don't know when back then, if he just stuck to his script, but someone said he's very, like when you watch him on telly, and if you watch him live now, he's very quick with the audience. Apparently he used to, every 20 minutes that he did, he'd force himself to do 5 minutes in the middle of banter, see what would happen, just to warm his muscles up for that. So again, that's like a thing you've got to respect on someone for doing, because there's a lot of people you watch and you think, you're scared to go out of your comfort zone, but he was like, he obviously realised it's a really useful skill, and he just made himself do that, and which, especially when you start doing stuff like that, is fucking, you must have some debts, and anyone who's prepared to die to improve, I always think, is a...
That's the way to do it. It's the only way to be fearless. Where are you at in the London, or the England?
In the pecking order?
Yeah.
It's really nice being over here, because there's like only like 3 other British acts, so I feel like I'm more special than... In England. But in England, there's so many of us.
Don't you feel like they're kind of coddled over here as an English act? I mean, it seems like because they're part of the empire. Australia and New Zealand just seem like to just fucking...
They love it.
Lick the balls of the English comedians.
But I get... Yeah, I know. It's weird because...
Oh, he's talking about a chip shop on Tottenham Court Road. He said, motherland.
He said the word cockney. I did that like in my show. I'd say about some guy doing a cockney... And they were just like... I was like, why are you... I was on stage, why are you laughing at this? We get nothing in England... But a bit of me like goes, this is not a fair reflection, but a bit of me likes it. Because it's interesting, because when I'm in England, you'll see, just, I like having an outsider's perspective now and again, because often I'm often just gigging in Britain and it's often hard because of the voice and stuff. Even though I'm not like Miles Jupp or Jimmy Carr posh, they see kind of young, kind of quite lively guy and speaking like Southern, some parts of Britain, you're against it straight away. Which is fine, I don't mind that. I like, you've got to come out and be funny. It's good. It's a real, like, that's, you've got to win him over. Whereas over here, I know you mean you're on a pedestal, but then when I'm in England, there's like, I see Canadian comics and people from abroad, and they go, what's the deal with you guys in the tube? And people just, the outsider's perspective just gives...
Right, that always works.
It's amazing. Like, yeah. It's the only, it's rare that you get, it's such a big, just pointing out shit that is just normal to us, but going, what's the deal with that? And they, people lose their shit. It's interesting. I don't know. It's like, it's not normal. It's not a fair reflection of your writing, I don't think, but it's, you know.
It's amazing in England how you guys can know exactly what part of the country someone is, where they're from by their accent, and then also like what level of education they've had. I, you know, to me, everybody in England, unless you got a really thick Cockney accent or a Geordie accent, to me it all sounds, you know, very similar.
Oh, it does sound similar
to me, yeah.
Okay.
So you're saying people, you go on stage and people hear your...
Oh, yeah. If I'm in Northwest, like Manchester, Liverpool, they think...
Because you don't sound posh to me. You sound like you're hiding it.
Yeah. Don't know what you're talking about, blood. I'm with my roots. Yeah. No, I speak... I don't know. This is just how I spoke.
My other favorite part of this trip so far was... We went to see the geyser, and you kept calling it a geezer.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we went to see the geyser spout off, and you kept going geezer. So when I went to see it, I pictured like some English guy standing there with a pint, just like spouting off about shit. You know, hey, how about these packies are ruining the country? Yeah. And, you know,
immigration is a disgrace. just
spouting off nonsense. About everything.
With a crowd slowly gathering. Especially at the moment.
Al Murray standing there just going off about things.
At the moment, that's very topical, bearing in mind what just happened in the southeast of England, in London, in Woolwich.
What, with the murder of the soldier?
Murder of the soldier, and then the old EDL, English Defence League.
Kind that's
of.
The racist people that
marched? Yeah, it's a minority, but it's just, you know...
Well, they seemed... They seemed to be pretty popular on the television coverage.
Yes, they were. You know, it's like... It's anywhere like... I mean, even here, it's more peaceful. You're going to, in different parts of the country, everyone's, you know, different. Even though it's 2013, there are people that have these ignorant thoughts.
Well, that was pretty brutal murder, you know, in broad daylight. And the fact they cut this guy's head off with a meat cleaver, and then they didn't run. They waited for the cops, and the guy said he wanted to fight. That was just incredible.
I can't believe, like... There was a person filming the guy straight off, like a yard from him.
Yeah.
I mean, this is kind of from a guy scared of a plant behind him, so I don't know if I'm the best
barometer. Right, I don't know.
I would have gone, and run away. But yeah, because, but that's, is that like a weird, we're in a world now where people film everything. It's like...
Yeah, I think the thing is now, and now because of the cell phone technology that we all have cameras on our phones, I think the conundrum of modern living is, if your neighbor's house was on fire, would you... help his family get out or call the fire department, or would you just stand there and film it?
Yeah, that's what everyone seems to...
It seems like the...
Why is it not like...
The void of emotion that people have with filming stuff. But that was a different thing, because that was... Here's these monsters. The guy standing there with blood on his hands and bloody knives. You think he'd wait at least for the news cameras to say his, you know, political rant.
Yeah, but it was, because it was that weird sort of, the scary thing about that is he had that weird sociopathic thing where he was like a normal day at the office.
Yeah.
But then it was that weird calculated thing.
It just been a little minor car accident was the way he was acting. Look, this guy pulled in front of me, I hit him, it's no big deal.
And you just, because presumably that was the first time he'd cut another dude's head off, you'd think.
Right.
But he was like, he must be so... like out of it that in his thought process that is like that, because you think after like 5 or 6 kills, I know I'm not a murderer, but then you, I have to qualify that, by the way, I'm not a murderer, because you think after that you've become numbed by it, but the first one he was just like, just normal day. But then also, but it was weird because that person filming him must have felt no threat, so he might, that's almost how it
right
have, and stood there, because if that's me, I'm thinking, well, this guy could just start attacking everyone.
Why didn't he start attacking other white Britons, you know, if he feels that way about the country?
Exactly. But it was a weird, like, I still don't quite get it, because they haven't boiled it. But he was in military uniform, the guy?
No, the guy had a t-shirt on that said, help the heroes, or something. Like, some, you know, charity that helps the army. Soldiers returning.
So they didn't even know he's in the army. They could have thought he was just like someone who's...
Could have just been a guy with bad enough luck to be wearing an army t-shirt.
Yeah, that's going to put... That sort of thing, that'll put people off supporting... That'll put people off... actively showing they support that charity. But it was they were just driving on, they saw him, pulled over and just fucking did it. That was it. Literally.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, for in somewhere like England, it's when it happens in the West, isn't it? It's so you don't hear about that. You become used to certain ways of people getting murdered. Usually that kind of thing that it would never happen to me. It happens in bad neighbourhoods or at night time when there's gangs and shit.
Right.
That's what you always think is like a law-abiding citizen in a modernised country, don't you?
But it's interesting because they put the fear in us after September 11th. I don't know how it was after the 7/7 bombings in London that there would be these sleeper cell people that now we should fear these individual attacks by.
Yeah.
And now they're, you know, like the Boston bombing thing and that Woolwich beheading of the soldiers. Like, man, who the fuck are these people? Where are they hiding?
Yeah, you can't, I mean, as bad as it is, you can't live your life. I mean, it's just, there's a site. I always think when I'm standing at waiting for a tube, what's to stop some sociopath not just pushing me?
That's why I always stand in the back of the
platform. I do the same. People think I'm a nutter.
Because I lived in New York City. In New York City, people always get shoved. Some crazy homeless guy shoves somebody in the front.
Because you do not have... Even like we're walking up to Nugget Point, one of the most beautiful parts of New Zealand, and you're walking along a thin edge. And even in my head, and I'm not... I'm thinking, if for 2 seconds my brain just went... And maybe jump... I could just jump off. So it just takes one handoff from some... Think about how many people get on the tube a day. And there's always someone on the train every week.
Yeah.
My housemate was next to someone who jumped under themselves about 2 months ago. There's another comedian, Benny Boot, and at the time he'd broken up with... He was on the way to a gig, but he was also going to break up with his girlfriend that day. And then next to him, a woman just jumped. He just, like, sensed them do it. And he said as soon as he did it, he just 180'd, walked off to got a whole bottle of wine and downed it.
Wow.
And he still did his gig. I was like, that's definitely, you're right. It was an unpaid gig as well. You're definitely allowed to cancel.
Well,
that's happened. That's legitimate. Anyway, sorry, we've gone a bit kind of...
Yeah, that was so...
comedy podcast.
Well, it's topical. It's something that we've lived through. You and I have been, you know, yeah. I've been making the joke about the great thing about the New Zealand newspapers is, you know, in the West, we've got bombings and shootings and disasters, and here it's a sheep in the road.
Yeah, yeah.
I was going to make the joke to you, you know, how soon are you going to start making jokes about that? But you don't do anything political.
Yeah, I don't know if it's like a... I've done the odd topical thing before, and then in my head, I'm like... I'm worried that... I don't know, it seems like I could work really hard on it or whatever, and then it's gone. Whereas I quite like the idea of, and I kind of try and do a new hour every year anyway, and I quite like honing it and working on it, but it'd be annoying if your laugh level decreases due to being further away. But I don't know, I don't really, with that sort of topic, I think people can make jokes about whatever they want, and it's fine, I have no problem with that, but I don't really like doing jokes about, I just like doing silly things I've noticed. It's kind of my,
yeah.
You've seen me talk harmless nonsense. I talk about killers quite a lot, in my hour especially, but it's more like a silly hypothetical thing rather than a
specific,
yeah,
gruesome things that have happened.
And also my problem with topical stuff is, I find anyway, but obviously everyone comes up, especially with Twitter now as well, there's like, someone's tweet the odd thing, but it almost becomes out there, like, and if I'm doing something topical, there's a fair chance. It's very difficult to do a topical thing, I think, that no one else is, because it's like giving a thousand people one topic to write on, and just by coincidence, two or three of you are going to come up with the same logic on it.
Right.
But it depends. Like, if I was on a topical TV show or something, then obviously I'd be, you know, I think I could do it if I wanted to, but it's more like what I'd rather concentrate on is kind of silly.
Being silly is great. Don't never underestimate the power of silliness. And, you know, and there's the trap of trying to be a Lenny Bruce or a Bill Hicks,
yeah,
and talking about things that are, you know, ugliness in the world that's happening that, you know, sometimes people want to forget that shit.
Yeah.
You know?
For me, the most high pressure thing you can do in day-to-day life is trying to reverse park your car in public. That is the worst, isn't it? As soon as you pop into reverse and it lights up, you just feel everyone around you going, I hope he cocks it up. So I'd love to see that. My favourite thing to see is someone try to get into a space, give up and pretend they weren't trying to park. It's amazing, because the drive goes fine. I'll just have to drop the kids off at school tomorrow. It's fine. Now, I'm about to park and I feel the pressure because I don't park like a proper man. The proper men in here do one-handed parking. I do two hands. I tried one-handed parking once, forgetting that I do not have power steering. So look, I was just cleaning the wheel pre-park. I just don't like it when it's dusty. To my right, I'm about to park. I notice three like proper gangster rappers, hats, hoods, chains, really cool guys. There's extra pressure on me. Don't mess this up. I went backwards and I touched the bumper of the vehicle behind me. And I know for a fact I touched it because one of them shouted out, "Bumper!" That did not help my confidence levels. I went in and out 5 times at exactly the same incorrect angle to the last time I've got my head on the wheel. I'm pretty close to just crying and driving home till I swear to God, one of them knocks on my window and goes, "Bruv, do you want me to park your car for you?" See, what kind of an adult lets another adult park his me? I was like, "Yes, that'd be lovely. Thank you very much." He was so much cooler than me when he got in. He went, "The thing is, man, I'm pretty good at squeezing into tight spaces, if you know what I'm saying." I did not know what he was saying. I thought he was really good at hide and seek. He got in, he nailed it, got out and went, "So, have you, like, just passed your driving test?" I should have said yes. That's the least embarrassing answer. But I panicked and went, "Nah, I've been driving for years." Then said this sentence, "I just don't park it very much." What does that even mean? I've just been driving around for 7 years, waiting for a gangster valet to park my vehicle for me. Felt like an idiot. I thought this could not get any worse. And he went, "Do you want me to tell you why I'm so good at parking?" I was like, "Not really, but go for it." I swear to God, he went, "I treat a parking space the same way I treat a woman. I enter it slow, smooth, and steady." And I'm just thinking, am I on MTV Cribs? What the... Then I thought about it, I realised maybe that's the reason I'm so bad at parking, because I also treat a parking space the same way I treat a woman. Whenever I see one that's available, I get overexcited, enter it at the wrong angle, miss, then drive home crying.
Yeah, no, like, there's even, like, Edinburgh Festival, which I'm going to again in a couple of months, and everyone has the whole vibe of the... Have you done a show there before?
I've visited and done sets there.
So you must have seen a few shows, and every show's got to have a point to it and real brilliance. Right. They love that, critics. But
a story and arc and a tidy cleanup where it all pulls together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But then there's
when me and my brother became friends, yeah. And I didn't hate him.
There's a real trend at the moment about, like, it's kind of been a bit parodied now, but a lot of people doing shows about people in their family dying and blah, 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 and it being a sadness to the show to have a bit of, which I think is nice to have some different, you know, textures in your show, but it became a bit like everyone's doing it. And I still think at the end of the day, like, even if I watch an hour of comedy, I want to laugh for an hour personally.
Yeah.
I think most punters do, but then people can do great different things and make people cry and change the way they think about stuff. And that's a great tool to be able to do as well. But I like watching someone that just makes me piss myself.
Yeah.
So I like to try and still, like, even though it's silly stuff, I still like to get people to think about something in a different way. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Even though it's not a big, it's not like, this is what's wrong with communism, you know, with capitalism and stuff like that, but just for people to go, "Oh, I've never thought of glove compartments, whatever, like that before," which is just, you know.
Well, when I've done 1 hour shows at festivals, I just want to slam them with jokes and some great stories and stuff.
Yeah.
There was a massively popular one man show this guy Rick Reynolds did in the mid 90s when I was living in San Francisco, and it got nationwide acclaim, a great title, "Only the Truth is Funny."
Okay.
And it was a great 1 hour. But the thing I didn't like in it was he talked about his mother was a single mom and she drank a lot. And she brought home guys and fucked them.
Okay.
And he, you know, and I felt really uncomfortable during the show. I was like, you know, why sell out your mom?
Yeah.
And why, I mean, I've had, you know, my dad and my sister die in recent years. It's like, I don't want to fucking bring up the worst thing that's happened to me in my hour show.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that.
Even if it's an award-winning fucking... our show at a festival, I personally would feel uncomfortable talking about.
Yeah, no, well, that's what's interesting, I think, mate, because there are so many different ways to do your set and to do now, and some people think the more honest, I like to be as close to truth as I can be in what I'm talking about. I like it to be a story that's as much truth with a bit of tweaking and exaggeration here and there. I don't like at the end just, and then here's a completely made up thing. There's certain things I wouldn't want to, I'm with you. I don't want to, especially stuff that's really, like, deep and is going to bring up.
Right, you're going to tell your dad's darkest secret and then you're going to go face him, you know?
Yeah, it's... I don't... Yeah, because some people go, say whatever you want, and it's on stage, but it's deep, and this is where it gets real bumpy. But no, it's, I talk about a teapot for all the show. I use it as a way of like keeping the show ticking along. Because I think an hour is a really long time to watch one human being.
Yeah. Out.
Even my favourite comedian, if I was watching them, I'd be like, this is like just long to, especially today's generation, mate, where we get, you know, bored after 7 seconds. Of,
right.
There'll be people watching that video of the guy fucking beheading a woman after like 4 seconds. Nah, let's watch a cat doing a shit on
right.
YouTube.
People yawning while
yeah.
it's beheading.
Oh, yeah, another beheading. Yeah, what haven't I seen? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, fucking... Could get a baby.
I can go to beheadings.com and see better shit than this. All day long.
Beheadings.com/ yeah, Asian, like different ones. yeah, no, so I think an hour's a long time anyway. So that's why in mine this year anyway, and see what the critics say or what the punters say, which I think is more important anyway. But I've got a thing to keep it ticking along because in Edinburgh, you're doing a show every day for 26 days and you do, some people forget different days of the week. Like we've been doing this tour and we're gigging every day of the week. Friday, Saturday, audience are more up for it generally. If you don't go on a Monday or Tuesday, the audience are just quiet. Like, I don't know about you.
I don't know. Some of these towns we've gone to, they've been starving for entertainment. And then apparently that's the only comedy show some of these places will get all year.
Yeah, yeah. These places are great when I haven't seen
it,
but then
up like, for it.
But when, so I did Auckland and Wellington and you did Auckland.
Yeah.
But I'd find like the beginning, actually, but then some, depending on the day, you just never know what vibes in the room. You're going to have some days when the audience is naturally quiet and it doesn't mean they're not loving it, but you know, I watch a comedy show for now, I can love it, and I can just be, I'm not in the mood to laugh loud. So if you just got something that keeps their attention, something I've learned from this is my third hour, you just want something that keeps it ticking along more. Because there's nothing, I don't know, I've had gigs where it's just quiet and you feel like a bloke talking in a room, like just arrogantly with a microphone for no reason. Because you know, there's no laughs, it's, or there's quiet laughs, it feels, that's one of the worst things in the world, I hate it. Makes me feel sick. But that's why I think it's nice to have something that just keeps it flowing a bit more. I don't know.
You and I did 2 weeks at the Classic in Auckland for the New Zealand Comedy Festival. And the second week you were on the show before me doing 7 o'clock and I was doing my hour at 8:30.
Yeah.
And the first time I walked in and I just only watched like about a minute or two of your act, I thought to myself, okay, cutesy English humor.
Yeah.
And then over the next couple of nights, I got there a little earlier and watched more of you. And I thought, okay, no, this guy's actually got talent.
Oh, cheers, man.
The more that I saw you do your hour.
Yeah.
And there was one show where I got to see you do pretty much all the hour. But now after doing this 2 week tour all over New Zealand with you, I respect you. I'm like, man, this guy's like working on jokes constantly. And it's like almost like you're approaching comedy like an athlete. I mean, you're up like running in the morning. You're not getting drunk. You're not chasing women. You're like, you know, you're looking after your body. You're working on jokes.
Do you want to go on stage with a camel pack? That'd be good. If I was just having
no,
a little
I just, I, but it, it's funny, like when you, and comedians do this all the time. I mean, everyone judges people instantly.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I only caught like a minute and a half and thought, oh, okay, yeah, I got this guy figured out.
Yeah.
But then the more I got to see you and know you, I was completely wrong. And I actually think you're going to be a massive star.
Oh.
I do. I think you're really lovable. You're really likable. And you're like a lovable little pixie or something. Yeah.
A magical little man that you find at the end of a rainbow. Yeah. That's the only thing about pixies, because we're hanging out with two massive guys on this tour. Well, how tall are you?
No, actually, we were standing next to each other at the bar.
Well, that's the same
I think
height.
We're the same height.
You're 5'11"?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. We're standing next to the BFG, which
yeah.
is...
Jesus, Guy Williams is what, 6'7"? And...
He's 6'5", but and Jesse's 6'3". I didn't even realise how tall he was.
Wow.
But yeah, do you have this thing? Because people always think I'm shorter than I am.
Right, but you're actually not short.
I've had people tweet me on for a show, going, just having how tall are you?
Yeah.
Everyone always thinks I'm 5'9". I don't know why this is. Where are those 2 inches coming away from? I think it's the proportion.
Well, I remember when I lived in Holland and I had the late night talk show, people in Holland would always, when I would meet them in real life, they go, oh, you look shorter on television. They were like,
I love that honesty. The first thing
that's the Dutch. They have brutal honesty.
I love people that do that, where they recognize you, and you're saying it's like their culture, but they do that thing where they probably like really like you, but they don't want to do that thing where they're like, oh my God, I'm a massive fan.
Right, right.
So they go, I need to kind of play this. So they just cuss you instead.
Right.
They were like, Were you there, in the pub last night? We had this, the ultimate... If anyone is a comedy fan out there, please, just three word advice. Don't just go and tell a comedian jokes.
Yeah.
So we had this this guy in the bar yesterday.
Yeah.
This old bloke.
Invercargill.
In Invercargill, like the most southerly point of New Zealand. And this bloke from Manchester. So I could initially... He goes, "You're from Britain, aren't you?" And I think I was wearing the same jacket I'd worn on the gala. "So you're on the gala," like that. And he went, "Okay, cool." And then he sort of didn't say anything negative or positive. That's fine. He goes, "Here's one for you." And he started telling me, you know, these real pub, like, dirty jokes about these different flavoured condoms and all that sort of thing. And the first joke, and I did that thing where I was like, "Okay, that's fine, yeah." You know, you're just like, in your head, all you're thinking is, get to the end of this so I can politely laugh and then I can turn around.
Right.
That's all I'm thinking is, and sometimes I've done it before where I'm like, I laugh at the wrong point because I don't want to be rude. I had this with a bouncer once, so this is like a tangent, but I had, I don't know if it's same in America, I find bouncers very uncomfortable at comedy clubs because they're normally quite nice, but I'm always a bit on edge that they think they've got to prove themselves and they think I think I'm better than them or for whatever. I was doing a Laughter Lounge in Dublin. You've done it before.
I love Laughter Lounge.
Great gig, isn't it? But this guy doesn't work anymore. This guy called Blue, this big, bald Irish guy. And I'd done the first night. He was really nice to me the next day. He said, "Tash, you're really great yesterday." And if someone just compliments me like that, I find it a bit uncomfortable. I'm like, "Thanks, but I don't want to be like, yeah, you're right," and then high-five him. He went, I went, "Oh, cheers, man." He goes, "Take the compliment." I was like, "Yeah, no, come on, I just appreciate it. I just feel a bit weird that you..." And then he sort of did that thing, goes, "You like jokes, don't you? You like funny stuff, don't you?" And I was like, yeah, I do. And he goes, "Check out this video." And then he got his video out on his phone. And this is what I'm thinking is like, make sure I laugh at the right point here so he doesn't bring on the cock. And he goes, it's a building site. And he gets his video out and you just see a guy with a video, his mobile phone, goes to a cement bag at a building site, lifts it up and there's a hole in the first floor. So I went, "Oh yeah, it's terrible health and safety." And he went, "That's not the joke." I was like, "All right." And then the video shows the phone going in and it just shows a man sitting, who's a builder, sitting on the toilet in a half-built building, reading The Sun, having a wank. And then that's the end of it. And then he says, "Oh yeah." But basically, just show me gay porn. That's basically what he showed me there. And I have to go, okay, cool. Can I now leave this situation? Because I'm fucking uncomfortable. But yeah, last night, sorry, the tangent was, this guy was telling us two or three. And you always, for me, an older guy telling you jokes is, it's just a recipe for some form of racism at some point.
Right.
And then me and Jesse are there, and he's kind of gone off again. He comes back and he goes, this Asian. And as soon as he said that, normally I just kind of just started, I went, "Look, man, me and Jesse both on set, dude, just don't do racist ones like that." And then he went, "It's all right, my wife's Asian." Like that, I was like, that's a new reason to me. I've heard like, it's okay, I can say that because but it's like he'd married an Asian woman so he could tell Asian jokes.
Well, it's like that great Stuart Francis line. He does like some kind of racist joke and then he says, "It's okay, I can say that because my parents are racist."
Yeah. Mate, I love Stuart Francis, he's brilliant. Quotable bastard, man.
Quotable bastard.
What's the word you really like me saying? Banana.
Would you say banana?
Banana.
Every morning he has a banana.
I have a banana every morning, yeah. What do you say? Bananas?
Hey man, you got any bananas?
Bananas. I think I can do a sort of good impression of you.
Let's hear it.
Every single guy has at some point tried to suck it on. I make it more, I don't know, not quite right, but I just really like that.
I'm that husky.
I love the husky. It's great. It's an amazing voice. I love an American drawl. It's really, I hate, my voice is so, that's just different. You find certain words I say fun and interesting, but I find them.
It's adorable.
It's adorable. Little pixie-like talent I've got there.
An effervescent pixie.
But it's really interesting what you said about when you judge someone, when you meet them, and then you... I love it when you... Because often you can... When you meet someone off stage, you can kind of get a vibe for... You must have met people at open mics and thinking, and you can tell if they're a bit of a nutter, what they're going to be. But there's always about one in ten who really surprises you, and you think, this guy's going to fucking be weird or bomb, and you go on and go, fuck, man. I love it when there's someone just slightly... proves me wrong, because that's what's great about it. You're always learning with this job. You never know what's the formula. That's why no one's...
Are you aiming for something specifically in this business? Do you want to be a presenter or...
No. Do you know what? Like, when I started, right, I thought every gig, like the first gig I did, I thought was going to be like the Comedy Store. So I invited all my friends down. I was like 18. And it was in this first round of this competition. And it was just above a pub in like Dean Street in London. And invite 40 people. because I was like nervous and I thought I'd get some friends there. I know some people do it different, they don't want anyone they know to. And they were just a whole audience. And the winner went through and collapsed. And I was against a guy called Chris McCausland, who's really funny. He's a blind comedian, he's great. And I went through and the claps. And then the competition disbanded before the final, probably due to the fact that people were rigging it by bringing all their mates in. But I thought
that works that way in the States too.
Really,
there's competitions, yeah. People bring their friends and then their friends go apeshit. So it's usually not the funniest guy that wins. It's the guy who brought the most boisterous friends.
But I thought you did that. I thought like you did 10 gigs and you were just on telly. That's how arrogant or just stupid I was. But now the more I do, and some people go, I want to be a presenter. All I want to do is I want to just do shows that people come to watch me at. Like just even doing, it's a pleasure doing Auckland and Wellington for a week of my show and people coming to watch, having just seen like a 4-minute clip on the Gala or whatever. So they've seen a bit of what you do and then they come and watch you. And that was just like, that's so nice compared to when these shows are great because they're up for it and they haven't seen a lot. But you often do a circuit gig and you're at the end of the gig, hey man, I loved your joke. And then they just quote another comedian's joke from the night.
Oh, that kills me when somebody, hey, I love that joke you did, and it was the guy before you.
Yeah, that bit about gypsies. And you're like,
I worked with some Mexican-American guy in El Paso, and he did a thing about slapping his girlfriend. And the guy, that thing you did about, you know, I was like, dude, that wasn't me, man. That wasn't fucking me.
Please stop spreading that.
I would never do such a thing, much less make a joke about it.
Yeah. But no, the goal is just, yeah, do shows where people come to watch you. And it, whatever, getting on telly, and if that helps that's what I'd like to do, personally. I don't want to be like, you know, some people are like, I just want to get in a, I don't know, is it different? Everyone says in America, and this, I may be wrong here, but a lot of people do it to get on sitcoms, and then that's their...
No, I think that was probably the paradigm in the 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
Not anymore. I think, you know, that a lot of people just do it, you know, because they're, you know, philosophical crusaders of the fucking laughter.
Yeah, yeah, you just, yeah. It's like a, I can never imagine not wanting to do the live shit because...
Like, right, and I always lose respect for people after they get big from comedy when they walk away from it and they don't do it anymore.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, it's hard to maintain your comedy muscle.
Oh, totally. Like, I've noticed there's a few people and they haven't done it for about 8 to 10 years and they come back and they start touring again. And they'll still have a good fan base from whatever they've done. And they'll still be good because they know how to do it. But they've missed the way comedy's evolved in those years. So you must have, I mean, from your experience, you see what becomes on trend and what the topics are. And if you, if you're not there, I could come on stage, if I'm not there for 5 years, and go, what's the deal with Facebook? And everyone's like, dude, that everyone's done that fucking material because...
Right.
But that's why I think it's important to always be keeping
an eye on.
Keeping the muscle going, yeah.
Well, that's what I told you. I love to go to open mic nights because it's important to see what not to do.
Yes.
Is it something? Who's doing, you know, what the topics that are cheap and easily done. It's just as important to see open mics as it is master craft comedians doing hours.
I don't think I do that enough now that you've said that. Because also they're fun to go down and you just chuck out. And often those gigs are the fucking hardest gigs as well.
Always,
those gigs
to
fucking 12 people who would normally know the other acts.
Yeah.
Because also if they don't know you're famous as well, if they don't know you're a professional comedian, in my respect, I'm not in any way famous, but if I come on, they just think I'm just another bloke who's done... Like, I've even gone on and tried new stuff at those gigs. People go, so what, how many gigs? You've done like 3 or 4? And you're like, fuck, man, that stuff was not funny enough. They're asking you those questions.
Right.
But that's the hardest place to break in shit.
I love that you're always working on new material. You seem to me like a guy that's, you know, always going out there trying. You're trying new material every night.
Yeah.
In the normal gigs.
At these ones, I'm like, I do it. I used to be like, I don't know, it's go through different phases of when you're doing it, when I started. Always trying new stuff all the time. Then you start getting your 20 and you go, that's what works. But I kind of just judge it on the gig. Like, in my head, I'm like, we're doing quite big rooms to big audience. So the kind of reward to failure ratio feels bigger, if that makes sense. As in, if you do one that just dies to 400 people, that feels really more like a dud joke than if it's in a room that's, you know, full of 9 people. But I've kind of gone, like, I mean, we're in these great places, but if I do 2 minutes, it doesn't quite work in Invercargill. I don't think it's going to fuck my career up, if that makes sense.
I don't know. I heard talent scouts in the UK and America are always...
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's a closed circuit television camera in Invercargill. And they're sitting in, the president of the show business is watching.
I'm not allowed back into England. Stop me at customs. Sure gone, mate. Go back to the South Island until you improve that bit of material. Yeah.
I think it's a very interesting time that you have gotten into comedy now that the English scene is kind of waning and that a lot of the work in London has dried up. I mean, it used to be very marginal comedians were making an exorbitant living there.
Yes, you could. Yeah. Like,
so how do you feel about you, where you are now and the fact that it's tightened a little bit?
Well, especially in the last few months and over the last year, I mean, from the person who books my gigs for me says to me, like a year and a half ago, you'd be like, Chris can't do Friday. He's got something else to come up. Do you want me to find a replacement? They go, yeah, find a replacement. Now, if they go, Chris, they go, fine. We've got a waiting list of 20 people who will step into it. But because I've been supporting Milton Jones until the beginning of the year, I've kind of been off the circuit and I'm here. And I'm going to be doing my warm-ups for Edinburgh, then Edinburgh, then I'm doing more. I'm going to have this year where I'm kind of off the circuit and I'm just doing the odd weekend, which is fine. So I've slightly missed how it's personally going to affect me. So maybe next year I'll start being like, shit, all these clubs have forgotten who I am or whatever. But I think what you're trying to say is it kind of a good or a bad thing? Is that what you're kind of saying?
Well, how do you feel being that you're not a beginning comedian?
Yeah,
you are
middle somewhere.
You are ripening into your comedic voice.
Yes.
And this is a very important time for you as a comedian.
Yeah.
Where the next 20 years of your material and working career is all gelling and you're going from caterpillar to butterfly right now. So how does it feel that the cocoon is not as warm and fuzzy as it was a few years ago?
Well, I don't know. Like my attitude just generally is, so some people, there's a lot of people you hear complaining, there's no trebles anymore, my Friday's empty. But what I do like about comedy, and although there are factors that can affect it, room, audience, 9 out of 10 times, if you've got the goods, you'll do well. So I think it means that the mediocrity has to, that they will not survive the mediocrity. So you have to write better stuff, you have to be funnier, and then you'll survive, I think.
Yeah, and that's what happened in the States. And when the bottom fell out in the mid 90s, it was the people who had passion for it and who genuinely loved stand up who stuck with it. It was the people who, were just doing it to make $100 on a one nighter got the fuck out of it.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing because it's the people that really love doing it that I always, yeah, I love it, and there's people out there who love it, and if those are the ones that are going to survive, that's a good thing, I hope, and I think it'd be interesting to see. You've seen it happen before then in America.
That's what happened in America, and we talked about this in the van the other day. I think that's exactly what's happening in England now, and I think it's great for the business. The scene's never going to go away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's an art form.
Yeah.
And there are enough brilliant people who perform it brilliantly. And people need to laugh forever. It's not going to just fucking one day go away, Yeah. But in the States, it's on fire now. And I think it's like a seesaw. When we're up, you're down. And fortunately, you guys are down and we're up now.
But you must always, I don't know if you always talk about this in this, but I find it really interesting how the American progression is so different to Britain. As in, maybe you're like the middling comedians doing well thing is because in Britain, you get to a certain level where you can do 20 minutes. And you can just do 20 minutes of perfectly what used to happen, which probably won't happen as much now, perfectly serviceable material. You could do the same 20 minutes fucking
forever.
That's 10 years at least.
I've seen it. That's why I said there was a lot of marginal comedians making a lot of money. I've been going there for years.
And you must be seeing.
And you see guys that just do the same 20 minutes forever.
And,
Jesus, what a luxury to only do 20 minutes.
I know.
And then you can go to do different clubs around London and only do 20 minutes. Where in the States, you build up to headliner.
Yeah.
And then you got to cover the check spot when they drop the checks. And then also when the waitresses come around and collect the checks and then bring their change. And
that does sound like, it's annoying enough when someone gets up to go for a piss during your...
I know. So imagine if I was doing some emotional bloodletting at the end.
Yeah. And then everyone died. And it was, check please. Can I pay for this? He's talking about dead people. It's boring me. Yeah, wow. Yeah. No, that's a different kind of... There must be like... You've got to fucking... To get to that level, you must have to be working a job as well to do that, to get to the point.
No. I mean, it's been the beginning. And then when you're... Fortunately, I started as a teenager. So I got through the early...
Look at our hands, mate.
My hands.
You and me have never worked
soft as a baby's bottom.
Yeah. There's a, yeah, it's funny.
My favorite thing about comedy is no heavy lifting.
Mate, yeah, I've turned up at the old shit gig, and you know when it's not set up right, and you know you want to set it up right, but then a bit of me like, come on, I'm not. I haven't come here to move tables, guys. I've come here to change lives with my jokes.
Please give it up for the comedy talents that are Mr. Chris Martin. Hello, London. So it's nice, there's a lot of people here. I'm one of these people, I'm only ever happy when I'm around people. I hate being on my own. And I got taken by my mates to quite a pretentious nightclub in West London called the Kensington Roof Gardens. Don't know if you've ever been there. They've got all these cocktails like mojitos and cosmopolitans. I worked out I don't like those drinks. I much prefer drinks at a house party at 2 a.m. when all the mixers run out. Because people start to improvise with their beverages. That is amazing, isn't it? I love it when you go, dude, what are you drinking? And they go, it's gin and skimmed milk. Out of a potty because all the glasses have run out. I love it. When you go, what does that taste like? Only time in the English language's sentence is ever used, they go, that's actually surprisingly drinkable. But my mates, they took me to this place and I heard this amazing story, the best story I've heard all years. They used to have real life flamingos on the roof of this nightclub, but they had to move them because one evening someone got drunk and threw one off the roof. Now, to me, that is amazing, because I think that could only ever happen in Britain. Any other country in the world, America, people would go, oh my God, a flamingo, that's amazing, let's take a photo. In this country, it's like, Dave, you fuck it, I'll chuck it. I bet we thought, why didn't it fly off? But then clearly they've all had their wings clipped. They wouldn't just be hanging out on the roof for a laugh. Because up they go, the mojitos here are surprisingly drinkable. But more than anything, I couldn't stop thinking, how baffled would you be if you're walking down the street drunk at 1 a.m? Yeah, mate. I know I've had a lot of drugs and a lot of booze tonight, but I'm almost certain I nearly got hit in the face by a massive gay pigeon.
So, let's talk about New Zealand and the New Zealand experience. I mean, it's been great. We did the tour of the North Island, and then this past week we did the South Island, and we've been riding around in a van. It's almost like we're a band and stuff. And you have amused me greatly with your Alan Partridge imitation.
Alan Partridge, yeah, he's. Do you like Alan Partridge?
I love Alan Partridge.
I mean, when I was younger, he was like, actually, he's probably my first real comedy influence before stand up.
That was the '90s, right?
Yeah,
late '90s.
Knowing me, knowing you, I watched a little bit of. Maybe it was a bit too young to fully get. And then he did a. On Alan Partridge, where he lived in a travel lodge, and yeah. All me and my friends were obsessed with it. We used to just turn up at school like the next Monday, whatever the next day after the episode went off. Lynn, I could cook a cat, and just put it's. He's got it's one of the best characters ever written in all of comedy. It's so accurate, and you must have experienced as well with these. Any local radio DJ in any part of the world is like him. You've had those chats on the phone with the local DJs.
Yeah. It's a brilliant show for anyone who doesn't know. You need to look into. I love Knowing Me, Knowing You, and then I'm Alan Partridge. Where he, Knowing Me, Knowing You, he's a guy who's got some, like, daytime, you know, cheesy show on English television, and then he loses his job, and then on I'm Alan Partridge, he's he gets a shitty job in Norwich on late night, as a late night radio host. And so he's still got his, like, TV personality ego, and he's living in a travel lodge, and I think the show's hilarious. Number one, the... When I fell in love with that show and was watching is that you would never see that in America where the star is an unlovable character. Because there's nothing lovable about the guy. There's nothing redeeming. There's no, he gives good advice to a kid at the end or something. It's always very sinister and self-serving ego vanity.
Yeah, I guess within the David Brent character is similar, you think, in The Office. It's not as different, but again, not lovable.
Right, yeah.
Maybe it's like in America, you still wouldn't get that. You wouldn't get an unlovable. Because I guess the American Office, I haven't really seen it probably, but everyone says that he's more likable, Steve Carell.
I never saw it. I liked the English one so much.
Yeah, the Partridge being an arsehole thing is... he's so naff that if he was like really if he seemed like he was clued on and being an arsehole, it wouldn't work, because he's just such a tit. Do you know what I mean? It works really well because he's... Yeah, because I've never actually thought of him as being proper. I know he's a dick and stuff, because I think he's just such an idiot that it kind of works. Yeah, he's just so naff and just cheesy that it kind of actually masks what a complete cock he is.
Well, I think it's funny that you're doing an imitation of him 15 years after that show was on.
Yeah, that's how good. The movie's coming out this year.
Let's hear the imitation.
Okay, what's that one where... in the first episode of the series where he's trying to get back on daytime TV, he's having a meeting with the head of the BBC, and he's like coming up with all these ideas, going, idea for a new show, monkey tennis, like that. And then he goes, no. And then just a random intermediate comes up to the head of the BBC, Tony Hares, and goes, oh, hi, Alan, how are you doing, Tony? What's happening? And Alan goes, I'm trying to get a second series. And he goes, oh, do you give them the second series? Tony goes, he's giving you a second series. Alan goes, no, he won't give me one. And he goes, oh, come on, give him another series, you swine. And Alan Potter goes, yeah, give me another series, you shit. It's just the aggression. And he runs out going, smell my cheese, picks a bit of cheese and runs out of the hotel. Yeah, Partridge, knowing you, there's a comedian in England called Matt Ford, and he won an Alan Partridge impersonation competition. He's mind-blowing. You're in England and you work with him, get him to do it.
What's the guy? Steve Coogan is the guy that did the Alan Partridge thing.
Yeah, it's genius.
And you want me to see his imitator?
His imitator is amazing. His imitator is fantastic. He nails it.
Okay, so let's talk about what have been your favorite experiences on this New Zealand comedy convoy tour.
Okay, we've done just the general camaraderie of the van. Like, normally when I'm driving for ages, I get bored after. But I've I slept the other day for a bit because we got up at 8:30. But there's always you've got so many amazing stories that if anyone out there gets to gig with Tom, just it's like you're like a story jukebox. Just want to keep putting coins into you. You've got so many amazing stories.
What have been your favorite stories?
I really like the chicken. I know it's a small. I don't know if I want to say it on here every time I eat a chicken wing, I'm always going to think of the
Jerry Seinfeld eating the chicken.
Jerry Seinfeld eating a chicken wing, because of that story. Two or three times, it's still the way you do the face really makes me laugh. And you told us a great one just at dinner just now about meeting Tom Waits. Tom Waits. That's a great story. That's good. Mate, loads. I just love it. It's like, because I've never worked in America as well, so I just and. I think in Britain, like you said, you thought we're American files to the point we have this interest in from seeing so much TV about it. So I find it really fascinating learning about what it's like working with all these comedians I've seen on the internet. So over here, you get the Kiwi acts who are just like, wow, oh my God, you know this British comedian, which just seems normal to me. But America still, I went to America properly for the first time last year, just with some friends, went to San Diego and Vegas. And it was like, in my head, I'm going to be like The Hangover in Vegas, and it wasn't that far off. That's what's crazy about it. For me, America is not as ridiculous as... It's not that far as...
Well, Vegas.
Vegas. My favourite thing about what I noticed when I was in San Diego is we say Vegas to anyone. I think it's maybe a difference between British and American people. Maybe I'm wrong here. You probably know better than me. But I found America quite a police state when I was in San Diego. Like, people are scared to not stop at those stop signs because they worry the police will... And they sort of have their kind of... Like, Vegas... In England... Like, despite the fact there's loads of fucked up stuff going on and the government aren't in everyone's good books, is you can kind of go have a few beers whatever night of the week and you can act like an arsehole in any part of the country any night of the week, especially if you're getting drunk with your friends. We've all done it when we were younger, drinking in parks and stuff. It seems like in America, they just save it all for Vegas. We were honestly, it's almost like we're going to Vegas. We're like, oh my God, Vegas, you're going to have so much fun, man. And we were like, we're going for 5 days. And I was like, dude, you're going to die. Five days? You're fucking mind.
5 days is too many.
In all fairness, it was definitely 2 days too many. The weekend was... The Monday, are we there till the Tuesday? The Monday I woke up was the most... It wasn't a hangover. My body was like, what are you doing to me? You're mental. But it was almost like loads of Americans like, yeah, can we have a little bit of fun? But Vegas is like where they go bananas. Whereas in England, you know, people just sort of do that probably too much on any night of the week.
Well, I mean, one part of me wants to say, hey, Vegas isn't America. And then another part of me internally thinks that Vegas perfectly represents our country. Yeah. I mean, it's the open love of money and excess and debauchery.
Yeah, it's
I mean, it's very forthright and honest about what it is.
And it probably is quite accurate. Though,
I'm glad that in recent years, because like there was like a 10-year period where they wanted to make it family Vegas.
Yeah.
And bring your families and all this shit. And then the economy collapsed, and now it's, you know, what stays in Vegas, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. They've re-embraced the debaucherous core that the place was founded on.
Yeah. It's also hilarious. I thought that everyone would be all suited and booted and dressed, and like managed to bring some... People just out there fucking in a basketball shirt and sandals, like just gambling till 4 o'clock. The old ladies and that, it's amazing. It's just, it is unlike any other place I've been to be honest. But it was very fun. Yeah, so in terms of your stories and stuff, I'm always just excited to hear about, because I've never gigged in America, and I think next year I'd like to, or in the next couple of years, just try and do whatever one or two.
Come over, not enough English guys come to the States, and
I want
to
come over
and try and give it a crack, you know.
I just want to see, be interested to, that's why even here certain stuff works better, and it's just fascinating to see how different cultures and different countries laugh.
Right, so what has been the highlight of your New Zealand experience?
Outside of the
gigs? What's your favourite part of the tour?
Okay, favourite part of the tour, just little silly, like the go-karting this morning. How fun was that?
To the death. It was great.
You're a fucking badass. You and your wife just doubled it. Your wife would be so slow, but not let anyone overtake her. Then you just, I was like, I'm going to try and pass. And you'd be like, fuck this shit, and just smash me in the ass from behind. It's just like you'd met up and done a team talk beforehand. That was really fun. You missed it on the first, we did lugeing on the first day, on like dry
right,
road lugeing.
I had to do a radio interview while you guys were doing that.
That was fun. And just seeing like, just the drives, until yesterday, the South Island, we hadn't seen a lot of real picturesque stuff. But yesterday's drive was great. You're seeing amazing views and the sea air. Just and like the North Island, you're going around these really amazing kind of vegetated like areas. Just like doing road gigs, but being excited to be on the road. Does that make sense? Often I'm like, I don't want to sit in a car for 3 hours. It's boring. And just a general camera.
It's been exciting. And you and I went to Hobbiton together.
That
was one of my highlights.
That seems so long ago.
And the fact that it was raining and we had a private tour of the place. And normally when people go on the tour, they can't go up to the door. They have to stay behind the fences. And that this guy let us get behind the doors and run up steps and things. That was awesome.
That was great. It feels about like 8 years ago now.
It does. Yeah, we've really lived a lot in the last month.
We've eaten great. The food
has been
exciting. Apart from the bloody, you know, because Jesse is Mr. New Zealand, he loves it. He goes, have a white bait fritter. It's amazing. That's the only bad meal we've had. White bait fritter, just in case you don't realise.
And Ewan really talked it up as well to me. And
just egg. Just egg with some dead fish in it.
Now, you found the restaurant in Hamilton, the Victoria?
No, I didn't. Guy and... Jesse.
That was the best restaurant so far. The Victoria tuna. Street Bistro.
All that tuna.
Seared tuna. Victoria Street Bistro, Hamilton.
Do you know, this is what I feel like a sad bastard. I'm 26, so I should be like, getting shit-faced every night. But I'm like, mate, a really nicely cooked tuna at a reasonable price. Yeah, that's eating good on this tour is one of my highlights.
No, and you know what? You remind me that, I'm sorry I didn't think of this before when we talked about Jimmy Carr, his dedication to comedy. Like, I think you kind of approach it like an athlete in the health aspect, but you work on your jokes as hard as he did. That's why I think, you know, this guy's going to...
Oh, cool.
I think you're going to do pretty well in this business.
I'd be very happy if I got anywhere near what he... But he's also a guy who's on tape, but he gigs every year still. He still gigs every year.
Right, because he loves it. He
does it, yeah. He's great.
Okay, and what do you think of the New Zealand audience?
I like him. I joke at the beginning that they normally... and these out-of-town ones, and these ones in the middle, that they are just bang up for it. I found Auckland and Wellington, they take a cut in an hour show, they take a couple of minutes to warm to you because... I think comedy's newer over here, so they're not used to the sitting for an hour and concentrating thing, which I kind of get on board with them because I have the same thing, an hour's a long time. So they sometimes take a few minutes and they're really polite, rarely are there heckles, compared to England anyway, but they're really appreciative at the end and very hard to get rounds of applauses, I've noticed. I don't know what it's like getting applause breaks in America, but I find it's very hard to get them to go, wow.
Right.
I think they almost feel like, but they go like, it's a bit weird. I shouldn't be clapping this guy. I'm showing him too much niceness. But they're very polite. I don't know if you think that's a similar kind of vibe.
Yeah, I thought Auckland, when I was doing my hour show, I thought they could be really touchy about certain things.
Yeah.
I've enjoyed the audiences and definitely going around the country. These beautiful little theaters that we've been playing are... Yeah. And the people are really excited, like it's a concert.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's nothing else to do in some of these, but this one should be great. We've
walked around. We're in Palmerton North. You got to go on stage here shortly. So do you have any questions for me?
Any questions for you? What's been your highlight of this tour as well? So I'm just going to throw it back at you. What's been your highlight?
Hobbiton. Definitely Hobbiton. I loved playing the classic for 2 weeks in Auckland. That was great. I loved the Hamilton shows. I loved New Plymouth. Invercargill. Oh my God, that was awesome.
That was last night,
Christchurch. That was phenomenal.
They only sold out one.
And then we got to go around the city and see all the earthquake damage the next day. And then I was like, I'm so glad we destroyed that show.
Because
these people really need to laugh. It shows you, like we were talking about at the beginning, that, like, you know, sometimes it's not good to address the shittiness of life and just go entertain the shit out of
people. We showed them the good type of destroying.
Boom.
High-fiving in the van. That's one of my favorite things.
Yeah. You're so American with the high-fiving. I love it.
Someone makes a silly joke in the van. It's good. High-five.
What has been the greatest advice you've ever been given for comedy?
After I began 2 or 3 years, I did a gig at Comedia in Brighton. Which I thought was a great gig. And I did an early and a late show, 10-minute spots in the middle. And in the middle, I went straight on off to my now housemate, Benny Boo. He had a great gig. And the first 5 minutes of my gig was fucking nothing. Because I used to run on and just, like, I've got to get to a punchline straight away. But Adam Bloom just said to me once, just announce yourself on stage. Just look like... And it's the most simple but sensible advice.
What do you mean by that?
Walk on and don't worry about getting to... Just look like... Because the audience are nervous when you walk on that you're going to be... They don't know. They think... If you look nervous, they're nervous. They think this guy's going to be shit. But just walk on and say, hello... How are we doing? Just make them relax in that you don't have to fucking say a big laugh in 4 seconds. I see loads of people now when I've been told that people closing shows who walk on, they might not do a joke for a minute, but they'll look like they belong to be there. So just announce yourself on stage is like a thing that you don't have to go on and be like, hello, hello Wembley. But yeah, don't run on and try and tell a joke quickly. It sounds so simple now, but I used to do that. It's just announce yourself on stage. And I see new acts do that as well. Got to get some punchline. Look like you belong to be there. Be relaxed, whatever your style. And then the audience will relax and they'll trust you.
No, I think that's excellent advice.
Announce yourself on stage,
Is there any advice or words of wisdom you'd like to give the people of the world?
They'll do their gigs, do their set, and fuck off. I think watch great acts close shows because you'll learn the most from those. And you said the open mics, but watch great acts be great.
You got to learn from the masters.
Yeah,
yeah.
It seems you're basically getting a free ticket to watching someone brilliant when you're doing a show, and it'd be stupid to not watch them be great as well. I think hang around, learn. Don't lift, but learn.
Don't lift, but learn.
That's brilliant.
That's brilliant comedy advice. Don't lift, but learn. Oh, and I'm so glad that just popped into my head because I was just about to shut this off. Your name is Chris Martin.
Yeah.
You share a name with a famous person. And there was a review and you showed it where I forget what town we were in. But the guy who wrote it should be ashamed of himself. Yeah. He said, oh, he's done working with Coldplay and his marriage to Gwyneth Paltrow. How often does that happen to you? And how much of a weighted yoke is that around your neck?
Do you know what? Like, when I first started, he was kind of getting famous as I was. And it was like, I had a joke about it for like 3 or 4 years. But I think if you just don't, it's really not an issue. It's just these sort of... People who are not used to writing art, local areas. It's like the first base.
Fortunately, I don't think he's going to have too many more hits, and I think you could easily overtake
him. Really? That'd be the dream. That'd be the dream, Tom. Do you know, I was going to change my name to Chris John Martin. He's got the same middle name as me as well.
That's some shit.
It's fucking bullshit. I said my favourite stupid thing about the name happened recently. I did a gig in Belfast. Came off stage, got a Facebook from someone in the gig going, really like the show. It's very nice. They went, just to let you know, at the end of your set, so I'd done 20 minutes, I'll say, it's been a good gig, an old couple behind me, one turns to the other one, that's that bloke from Coldplay, isn't it? And you're like, yes it is. I love that, just thinking, you know, he's doing well with the music, he likes to do a little bit of support work for Milton Jones on the side.
He's getting bored with marriage, yeah. He wants to get out of the house.
Just mix it up.
cover every base.
Okay, so I got nothing but respect for you, Chris. I'm happy to be your friend.
Thanks,
and
man.
If I will be happy to help you when you come to America, if you could go take us out with a little yellow.
Oh, God, no. I'm out of here, mate. This is bullshit. You're never invited to Waitrose in Chiswick, ever.
Kick out. I love that place. All right, brother. Kick ass in Palmerton North.
Thanks, mate.